From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. As the U.S. announced it will move its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem by the end of 2019, the European Union voiced support for its long-standing position for a two-state solution with East Jerusalem as a future capital of a Palestinian state. Speaking to the Israeli parliament, Vice President Mike Pence underscored President Donald Trump's decision last month to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
Jerusalem is Israel's capital. And as such, President Trump has directed the State Department to immediately begin preparations to move the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
He said that will be complete by the end of 2019. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas received support from European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini, who told reporters later the only way to peace is a two-state solution.
Clearly there is a problem with Jerusalem. I would say this is a very diplomatic euphemism. We Europeans, as well as all the Arab world the United Nations system as such, still continue to believe that the only pragmatic, realistic solution for Jerusalem has to come through direct negotiations has to be the capital of two states.
Mr. Abbas urged the EU to swiftly recognize the state of Palestine. He said it would be an encouragement to the Palestinian people. South Africa's ruling African National Congress is debating whether to cut short the tenure of President Jacob Zuma, who was replaced as party chief by Cyril Ramaphosa last month. Mr. Zuma, who has been in power since 2009, has been dogged by allegations of mismanagement and corruption, seen as harmful to the South African economy and the party's standing with the public. He could be removed by a motion of no confidence in Parliament or by the ANC National Executive Committee. This is VOA News. In northwest Syria, Turkish troops continue their advance against Kurdish militia in Afrin province, day three of Operation Olive Branch. The top UN official in Syria, Ali al-Zaatari, resident humanitarian coordinator, said it's unclear how many people are fleeing the operation, but called the situation difficult.
Because the access that they have to basic necessities is rather constrained. Prices of commodities are high. Medical services are low.
Turkey views the YPG Kurdish units operating in that border region as a security threat and part of the outlawed separatist Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. Turkish officials and rebel allies began their operation Saturday to push YPG away from the Turkish frontier and create a 30-kilometer-deep safe zone. The U.S. Congress voted Monday to reopen the federal government 3 days into a partial shutdown, triggered in part by a partisan dispute over immigration. Late Monday, the House of Representatives approved the measure passed earlier in the Senate, where Mitch McConnell is the majority leader.
Madam President, after 3 days of an unnecessary lapse in funding, a bipartisan majority has brought the Democratic leader's extraordinary filibuster to an end and passed a bipartisan bill to reopen the federal government.
McConnell urged Democrats the Senate take up immigration, reassured Democrats the Senate would take up immigration matters, including the fate of tens of hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants brought to America as children. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Washington must pay close attention to its special relationship with Britain, even though President Donald Trump has yet to visit London.
Both from a security standpoint, but also from an economic standpoint. And we need to pay attention to that relationship and the importance of this relationship on a bilateral basis as well, while we work together in common cause to address some of these serious conflicts around the world that confront both of our nations.
Tillerson also plans to meet European signatory nations to the Iran nuclear deal as the Trump administration seeks changes to that 2015 agreement. Pope Francis Monday offered an apology to victims of clerical abuse following his defense of a bishop in Chile during his just-concluded week-long visit to Latin America.
Cosa sentono gli abusati?
The Pope said he hurt them without realizing it. Last week, in defense of Bishop Juan Barros, Francis said there was no evidence he was protecting a priest found guilty by the Vatican of abusing teenage boys. That view came under criticism during his trip. A new report Monday suggested UN peacekeepers need to change how they operate to reverse a trend of escalating fatality. The report said the blue helmet and UN flag no longer offer natural protection. It said UN forces need to be strong and not fear the use of force when necessary. UN peacekeeping casualties have been on the rise since 2013. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's 25th president, George Mani Weah, took the oath of office Monday with a promise to fight corruption.
It is my belief that the most effective way to directly impact the poor and to narrow the gap between the rich and poor is to ensure that public resources do not end up in the pocket of government officials.
But how would Weah fight corruption given that his predecessor acknowledged he failed over 12 years to rein in corruption? We'll have analysis. The Gambian government announces the arrest of two close aides to former dictator Yahya Jammeh, and Kenyan women demand more gender participation in government.
The women of Kenya are tired of being treated like second-class citizens and now stand together to ensure that we take our rightful place at the decision-making table. We will continue to agitate and use all means at our disposal to ensure that our demands are met.
Wangechi Wachira is the head of the Center for Rights Education and Awareness in Kenya. The Ugandan government said its military attacked the rebel Allied Democratic Forces, or the ADF. And Uganda's main opposition, FDC, calls for the resignation of the Inspector General of Police. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's 25th president, George Mani Weah, Monday took the oath of office at a ceremony witnessed by scores of other African leaders, mostly from the West African sub-region. Weah succeeds Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Africa's first elected female president, who has led the country for the last 12 years. In his inaugural address, Weah promised to fight and win the war on corruption.
My fellow citizens, ladies and gentlemen, it is my belief that the most effective way to directly impact the poor and to narrow the gap between the rich and poor is to ensure that public resources do not end up in the pocket of government officials. I further believe that the overwhelming mandate that I receive from the Liberian people is a mandate to end corruption in public service. I promise to deliver on this mandate. As officials of government, it is time to put the interests of our people above our own self-interest. It is time to be honest with our people. Though corruption is a habit among our people, we must end it. We must pay civil servant a living wage so that corruption is not an excuse for taking what is not theirs. For those who do not refrain from enriching themselves at the expense of the people, the law will take a course. I say today that you will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
President Weah also extended an invitation to foreign and domestic investors to invest in Liberia, saying the country is open for business, but he said Liberian entrepreneurs will be given priority under his leadership.
I say to you, Liberia is open for business. We want to be known as a business-friendly government. We will do all that is within our power to provide an environment that will become conducive for the conduct of honest and transparent business. We will remove unnecessary regulatory constraints that tend to impede the establishment and operation of business in a profitable and predictable manner. As we open our doors to all foreign direct investment, we will not permit Liberian-owned businesses to be marginalized. This victory could not have been possible without the support of the youth of this country, the women of this country, especially those who make their living by selling in the markets. To all of you, I want to say a heartfelt thank you. This is your government.
The new Liberian president also promised to make reconciliation one of the hallmarks of his administration.
During my tenure as president of Liberia, the loudest battle cry that must ring from the mountain of Wologisi to the peak of Yekepa, from the ranges of Putu to the hills of Bomi, and from the coast of Harper to the shores of Monrovia must be the cry for national unity. We should strive to put aside our differences and join hands in the task of our nation building. We must learn how to celebrate our diversity without drawing lines of division in our new Liberia. In the walls of our national anthem, a union strong, success the show. We cannot fail. United, we are certain to succeed as a nation. Divided, we are certain to fail.
That was new Liberian President George Mani Weah speaking Monday soon after he was sworn in. Newly inaugurated Liberian President George Weah has promised that there will be no place in his government for corruption. But how would he fight corruption given that his predecessor, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, acknowledged she failed in 12 years to rid Liberia of corruption? President Weah, who draws much of his support from the youth of Liberia, many of whom have no jobs, also said his administration will try to have a positive impact on the lives of the youth. Rodney Sear is publisher of Front Page Africa, Liberia's leading print and online newspaper. He says while the new president gave a beautiful inaugural address, he was disappointed in that Weah did not demand for members of his cabinet to first declare their assets.
I think there were a lot of people who were skeptical about the delivery, but I think he made some strong points. I was a little bit disappointed in the way he spoke about corruption. Although he said his government would clamp down on corruption, I thought he would go a step further in asking or demanding that officials in his government declare their assets. As you know, accumulation of wealth is one of the main points that lead to corruption in government. In 2005, his predecessor, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, did similar thing when she said all her officials, including her, would be asked to declare their assets. They did so, but those assets were not made public. So I was expecting something more from Mr. Weah in terms of going a step further to really get to the bottom of this thing.
But Rodney, he said that the overwhelming mandate he received from the Liberian people is a mandate to end corruption in public service, and that he promised to deliver on that mandate. What else could he have said?
Well, you can't fight corruption if your officials have not declared the assets. So how do the media know whether they accumulated assets over the period of time? So I think maybe it's too early, but I think he needs to go a step further in demanding that all of those who will be appointed in this government declare the assets.
I was in Liberia during the runoff election, and I saw the passion with which the young people threw themselves behind Weah. I think it'll be a challenge now. How does he improve the condition of these young people, the youth, who are the backbone of his support base?
The bulk of the expectations that people are expecting falls on the youth. What does George Weah do with those young people? And I think that would be one of the first order of business for his government. It would be interesting to see how they plan on doing that. Maybe they'll go the route of vocational training, they'll go the route of, you know, having them employed in some place of business where they can earn something for a living, or maybe go back to school, you know. But it would be interesting because I think we're looking forward to see how he hopes to implement this for the youth, because it's going to be very, very complicated and difficult going forward.
Coming into the inauguration, there was some press reports or some analysis given by some people that the Weah government was coming in unprepared because people weren't too sure who are the key cabinet members that Weah was coming up with. Now, I just received here information from the new administration of Weah that he's holding on to certain ministers from the government of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. What's the significance of holding these people over?
As you know, there were a lot of speculation that Mr. Weah and Madam Sirleaf had an understanding that they were going to, you know, work together in terms of having some of her officials serve in this government. We're not sure whether this move is permanent. The only minister who has been relieved of his post right now is Brian Samakai, the Minister of National Defense. He's the longest-serving minister in the Sirleaf government. He was let go. I understand he was not interested in staying on. As you know, the Minister of Education, George Wenner, was very supportive of the Weah campaign. Yiji Nanme is a very strong ally to Madam Sirleaf. So those two, I would say, were very loyal to the president. And holding them over for now suggests that Mr. Weah may be leaning toward giving Madam Sirleaf some of the things that she may have requested from him.
There's a lot for you, the local media there, to continue to write about as this new administration takes shape. Thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you, Dennis.
Rodney Sears is publisher of Front Page, Africa, Liberia's leading print and online newspaper. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 23rd. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. The Gambian government has announced the arrest of two close aides to former dictator Yahya Jammeh following their return from exile in Equatorial Guinea. The former army officers sneaked into the country unnoticed, but were later taken into custody on Sunday by the Gambian military police. As VOA's Pandere Umbai reports, a search led by the army to locate some of the returning former Jammeh aides is on.
Two top former Gambian army officers who went to exile in Equatorial Guinea with dictator Yahya Jammeh are back in the country. General Anshumana Tamba is the former commander of the State Guard Battalion. He landed at the Banjul International Airport over the weekend on board a Moroccan airline. Tamba was accompanied by General Umpa Mendi and others still said to be at large. Even though they were declared wanted by the Gambian state, Tamba and his men checked in at the airport without being noticed. Masane Kinte is Gambia's chief of defense staff.
I can confirm to you and the rest of your audience that Brigadier General Bamendi and Brigadier General Asmara Tamba are currently under military custody. They do have been arrested by the members of the Gambia Armed Forces military police, and they are invited by the Gambia Armed Forces to help us in our investigation.
Kinte told the state media that efforts are underway to establish how Tamba and co entered the country.
Well, that is something we are trying to investigate. And like I said, I've confirmed to you that these people are presently under military custody, and we have started the process of the investigation. I don't want to, you know, say anything more than that at this point in time.
Both General Anshumana Tamba and Umpa Mendi, a former principal close protection officer, has been under the radar of the Gambian justice system. They have been accused of being complicit in Jammeh's crimes against the Gambian people. Pa Samba Jau is a Washington, D.C.-based Gambian human rights activist.
Well, it's a very interesting development. First, I think it is great that they are in custody. But what I found absolutely troubling is the fact that these people who are known to have been Jammeh's close loyalists, people who are accused of committing serious human rights violations or crimes, that they could just slip in the country unnoticed or unarrested until a few days later. I think that should be of concern to every Gambian. And I believe that it shows that maybe this government is not up to task with a security concern.
Mr. Joe also notes that Jammeh's funds might be drying up, hence which led to his former loyalists abandoning him. The Gambia of late has witnessed a surge in crime rate, ranging from petty stealing, armed robbery, and in some occasions murder. Pa Samba Joe believes that the Barrow government has been found wanting in the area of security.
There is a lot of complacency in how this government is operating. I believe they have to, at this, first of all, you cannot have people who help Jammeh ruin our country surround you and be your advisors, security advisors, and other things, and expect to have different results. I believe this government must act swiftly to ensure the security of this country. And what I also believe is the fact that maybe the mere fact that we have economic in this country made this government so relaxed with our security situation.
A retired Gambian security chief tells VOA that the current security situation in the country is not only worrisome, but disturbing. He knows that the mere fact that former Jammeh loyalists can enter the country unnoticed goes to show that there is an intelligence failure in the country. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandere Umbai reporting.
Hundreds of women marched through Kenya's capital, Nairobi, on Monday to protest what they say is President Uhuru Kenyatta's failure to name women to at least one-third of government positions, as he is required to do by the country's constitution. Rael Ombuo has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
Ago, President Uhuru Kenyatta unveiled a cabinet shakeup, naming nine people for high-ranking government positions. Not one of the nominees was a woman. The president also dropped all five women in his earlier cabinet. It is for this reason that activists led by the head of the Center for Rights, Education and Awareness, Wangeshi Washira, marched the president's office at Harambee House to present him with a petition demanding the appointment of at least 9 women to the cabinet. Washira said there is no effort within the government to ensure the principle of gender equality enshrined in Kenya's 2010 constitution is being adhered to.
The women of Kenya are tired of being treated like second-class citizens and now stand together to ensure that we take our rightful place at the decision-making table. We will continue to agitate and use all means at our disposal to ensure that our demands are met and that the right to equal political participation and representation is realized and at all levels of decision-making in Kenya.
The 2010 constitution was seen as a victory for women who for a long time were sidelined in politics and decision-making positions at the state level. The constitution required that women hold at least one-third of seats in parliament and a third of appointed state positions. It also sets aside 47 special parliamentary seats for women. Despite this, the gender requirements have never been met. In Kenya's latest election held last year, just 23 women were elected to regular seats in the National Assembly. Two Kenyan rights groups have petitioned the High Court to make the government follow the constitution and appoint women to top positions. The court has not said when it may issue a ruling. Rael Ombor, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Ugandan army says it launched artillery and air attacks on the Allied Democratic Forces, or the ADF, a rebel group based in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo that is considered a terrorist organization. Lieutenant Colonel Dio Akiki, Ugandan Defense Deputy Spokesman, says the attacks are aimed at reducing the ADF threat to not only the East African region, but also the whole world. Mugumi Davis Raka Rich reports from Kampala.
Kanakik says the raid, which started late last year, was carried out by a joint operation between the Uganda Army and the DRC forces.
It has been attacking Congolese forces. So through sharing intelligence, we were able to carry out strikes using our air force and using long-range artillery to destroy and disorganize their camps. The intention was to do that, and then the ground forces from Congo can continue with operations, which they are doing.
Kanakik says the UPDF cannot just look on as the ADF terrorizes the region.
ADF can't be in Congo forever. It keeps our country on tension. It keeps the region on tension. As you can see, not only regional, now international, because if which force attacks a United Nations force? If ADF attacks a United Nations force, it is attacking the world. ADF is coordinating with other terrorist organizations like Al-Shabaab, like ISIS. These are international terror groups that shouldn't be taken for granted when they coordinate with a smaller group like ADF.
He also claims intelligence from the Uganda Army found out that the rebels were planning an attack on Uganda through the western district of Bundibujo. In the 1990s, the ADF rebels killed hundreds of people in the DRC and western Uganda districts of Kasese, Bundibujo and Kabarore. The DRC government and the UN mission in DRC, or MONUSCO, accused the ADF of having killed 700 civilians and combatants in eastern Congo from 2014 to 2016. The ADF is also accused of killing 14 UN peacekeepers in eastern Congo on December 7th last year. Kanakik warns the ADF shouldn't be taken lightly.
I think what is important is a combined effort of the ICGR, countries in the Great Lakes region, and also, of course, a lot of cooperation, which has been going on with the Congo to make sure that this is eliminated.
ICGR stands for the International Conference for the Great Lakes Region. The bloc includes countries such as Angola, Burundi, Central African Republic, Republic of Congo, and Democratic Republic of Congo. Others are Kenya, Rwanda, Sudan and South Sudan, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zambia. Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni this month held a series of meetings with the army chiefs in the ICGR to discuss a way forward towards the fight against the ADF rebels. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Uganda's main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, has called for the resignation of the Inspector General of Police, General Kale Kayihura. The FDC says General Kayihura failed to provide adequate protection for citizens as required by law. The FDC's call came after military intelligence arrested the leader and 27 members of a motorcycle operators group known as Boda Boda 2010. The group is accused of murdering a case hospital accountant. The opposition FDC says the police chief is on record to have praised the motorcycle operators group. Patrick Oboy Amurayat, who's chairman of the opposition FDC, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the inspector general must resign due to his links to the Boda Boda 2010 group.
Anybody following the politics of Uganda now would know that a militia that was backed by the IGP to carry out operations, particularly within the city of Kampala area and the surrounding areas, has now been discovered to be part of a criminal gang that has been terrorizing people and have believed to have been the cause of a number of killings within the capital city and the immediate neighborhood of the capital city. And so for us, we think that the judgment of the Inspector General of Police is one thing, and that really we as Ugandan people would not be wise to entrust our security into his hands.
President Museveni made the appointment or choosing him as the Inspector General of Police of Uganda. Do you think that your call will be adhered to by President Museveni?
Well, I think the choice is really his. He is the appointing authority. General Kaihura seemingly is one of his trusted cadres. He has even said this in camera. He is a cadre. And then, you know, it's not long ago since he was his term of office was extended. And so, yes, he could be one of his right-hand people. But it is really the choice is his. If the police is an institution that can ever be trusted to take care of the peace and security of the people, then I think Mr. Museveni may really not have so much choice but to cause changes to happen within the police force.
Supporters of the National Resistance Movement, the ruling party, are saying that your call is just political posturing because General Kaihura, the IGP, still has the confidence of President Yoweri Museveni.
This country belongs to us all. I think really the mindset of our friends in the ruling party is fixated in such a way that they are living in some form of denial. You know, the weaknesses within the police force is glaring, and it's there for everybody to see. So if they would like to play the ostrich, hide their heads in the sand, that is really their business. But, you know, for us, our advice to them is that everything is going wrong within the police force, and they have a duty to the people of Uganda to ensure that the trust that the police force should have is built, and you know, where it has been broken, then it is up to them to see how it will be restored.
Patrick Oboy Amurayat is the chairman of Uganda's main opposition, FDC. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. And that is it for this Tuesday, January 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service at the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a nice day.
Hello, I'm Lino Armudu, host of Health Chat. Join us this Tuesday as we bring you some highlights of ICASA 2017, the International Conference on AIDS and STIs in Africa that took place recently in Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-691-3111. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.